This Marketplace podcast is supported by SoundView Executive Book Summaries. SoundView summarizes the best business books of the year and hosts interactive events with today's top business authors. Try it for free at summary.com/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One wonders if there's any there, if the buyouts on Wall Street are at all related to what's happening in the economy. Wall Street's abuzz with mergers and acquisitions, and economists say things are on the rebound. So on a day with more deals done, one really has to hope there's a connection. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Monday, the 4th of June. Great to have you here, as always. Before we go any further, though, I should probably tell you that what I'm about to suggest might void your warranty. But go get a screwdriver and take the back off your favorite electronic appliance. Doesn't really matter what it is, a Dell computer or a Sony DVD player, maybe a cell phone, whatever. Have a good peek inside. Chances are most of the electronic bits you're looking at weren't actually made by the company whose brand name is on the gizmo in question. Singapore's Flextronics is the world's second largest manufacturer of electronic components produced for retailers. This morning, it announced it's buying the number five company in the market, U.S.-based Selectron. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
If you haven't heard of Singapore-based Flextronics, you've probably heard of its customers. Technology analyst Roger Kay says companies like Hewlett-Packard, Eastman Kodak, Motorola, and Xerox outsource to Flextronics.
And what they do is a range of services from designing to figuring out how to manufacture to actually making electronic goods, which other companies then brand and resell.
Flextronics deals mostly in consumer electronics. California-based Selectron does the same thing, but it specializes in business products. Today, Flextronics said it would buy Selectron for more than $3.5 billion. Kay says it makes sense for the companies to join forces because the services they offer aren't very different from one another.
They own the process, the ability to do it, and they own some real estate, places to do it. But when it comes to what do they have that's truly unique, there's not that much. And because their customers are in very competitive environments, they can't take much out of the sandwich.
Steve Biggs is a computer analyst with Zacks Investment Research. He says companies like Flextronics got their start buying the manufacturing assets of the companies who are now their customers.
That has already played out. So the growth now is, I think, going to be mostly through the companies acquiring each other.
There's still plenty of competition in the sector, so analyst Roger Kay says Flextronics won't be able to demand higher prices from the electronics giants. He says the deal probably won't affect consumers much either. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The other big corporate story of the day is a buyout as well. Of sorts, anyway. Palm announced it's selling a 25% stake to the private equity group Elevation Partners for $325 million, and it's hoping for some reflected glory. It's going to add the guy who used to run Apple's iPod division as its executive chairman. Subprime mortgage lenders might well be the next hot buyout target. Today we learned the private equity firm Lone Star Funds will pay $400 million cash for accredited home lenders. That's a nice premium to Accredited's closing stock price Friday, though it's a ways off the pre-subprime meltdown high. Lone Star is not the only buyout gang throwing money at subprime's corporate wreckage, as Marketplace's Steve Tripoli reports.
Private equity firms and hedge funds are tossing around money all over the subprime world. And with subprime lenders' stocks depressed by tanking portfolios, the prices look nice. But analyst Bose George at Keefe, Bruyette & Woods says buyers are assuming things can't get worse.
Baked into the assumption are certain views on how the mortgage market stabilizes and where the bottom is. And from our perspective, it's a little hard to really call that bottom yet.
Jeff Kirsch buys defaulted mortgages at American Residential Equities in Miami. He thinks there's still trouble to come in subprime.
I see further contraction. I see legislation. I see more defaults. So I'm just not optimistic about the mortgage business and certainly don't believe that it's a growth business over the near term.
But his key words there are near term. Kirsch says the buyout artists hope to cash in further out. Like the depressed condo market in his Miami base, prices are down in subprime. Inventory is plentiful.
Yet there are private equity and hedge funds that are interested in buying huge blocks. So over the short term, you'd say, well, that doesn't make any sense. But if you take a more European Asian view towards real estate, you say, well, maybe if you look at it over a 10 or 20 year period, it does make sense.
There's one other worry from this buyout trend, that rescuing subprime lenders may also resurrect their reckless lending habits. Analyst Bose George says, don't worry. The original lenders were big risk takers looking for a fast fortune. The new guys like money too, but they're willing to build profits a little more slowly and safely. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
The money-back guarantee is a staple of American commerce. You find them in industries from electronics to sporting goods, not so often in the field of healthcare. Now, though, a British division of Johnson & Johnson has offered to refund the cost of one of its cancer drugs if it doesn't work. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Jackie Pickles suffers from myeloma, a cancer of the bone marrow. The condition is incurable, but last year she took part in a clinical trial of Velcade, and she says it's improved the quality of her life and prolonged it.
I'm as good as I've ever been with multiple myeloma, and I've suffered for it for 5 years. I'm back at work and feeling a valued member of society.
Other myeloma sufferers in Britain are not so lucky. So far, the state-run National Health Service, which provides free healthcare for all, has refused to prescribe Velcade. Why? Because it costs $6,000 for a single course and it doesn't always work. But now the manufacturer has made an unusual offer. We'll sell the drug and then refund the money if the patient's health does not improve. Andrew Dillon, head of the body that weighs up the costs of new medicines for the NHS, likes the deal.
It's important that when we've got a drug that is effective for some patients, that we tailor our arrangements so that those patients can get access. And potentially, this is one way of doing that, and doing it in a way that makes sense for the NHS with its inevitably limited funding.
The drug company is still haggling nervously over the details. Roger Goss of Patients Concern is not surprised.
Drugs are not guaranteed to do everybody they're tried on good, so they might find having to pay back quite a lot of money.
Nevertheless, he says this novel approach could enable the NHS to prescribe a wider range of hugely expensive new drugs. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The head of the Energy Department's price tracking division said today he thinks gasoline's hit a short-term high. Guy Caruso is predicting a 5 to 10 cent drop over the summer, which leads you to believe he must not have seen the weather report today. There's a tropical cyclone approaching the Persian Gulf. U.S. crude rose $1.13 to $66.21 a barrel. There's no rule that says you can't serve in the House of Representatives if you're the subject of a federal criminal indictment, which will probably be the single bright point of the day for Louisiana Democrat William Jefferson. The FBI found $90,000 in a box in Jefferson's freezer almost 2 years ago. Loot the feds say was part of the proceeds of a bribery scam that he was running. Jefferson was indicted today on 16 counts, everything from racketeering to obstruction of justice. Investors shook off some bad news of their own and found their happy place. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A funny thing happened on the way to a market meltdown today. Nothing at all. Wall Street and investors almost everywhere ignored news from China that the Shanghai Composite Index tanked 8.3% overnight. It's a rare instance of China being on the economic fringes. Chinese President Hu Jintao will be a special guest at the G8 summit starting Wednesday in Germany. Chancellor Angela Merkel has said she wants to spend some time there discussing climate change. And so President Hu will probably face some tough questions about China's action plan for global warming that was released today. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Emerging economies like China need to be given enough space to grow. That's how Chinese economic official Ma Kai put it in Beijing today. Half the people here live on $2 a day or less, which is why Ma says China and nations like it should be excused from tight controls on carbon emissions.
Their overriding priority at the moment is still economic development and poverty eradication.
Beijing's climate plan rests on energy efficiency. Each year, the voluntary goal is to burn 4% less energy per unit of growth. Think less coal per widget. Paul Harris of Hong Kong's Lingnan University says that will slow the growth in emissions, but
this will do nothing to delay China overtaking the United States to be the number one national source of greenhouse pollution.
Beijing and Washington will both be on the spot at the G8 climate talks. And Harris says at times like this, China adopts a familiar strategy. Again, Ma Kai.
Developed countries must shoulder the obligation to provide financial support to developing countries as they fight climate change.
He says wealthy countries spewed 77% of the world's greenhouse gases the last five decades. Class warfare? Perhaps. But in the end, Paul Harris says China and the developing world have more at stake here.
The climate changes that are affecting them and will do in the future will be much more difficult to cope with simply because they are poor.
If and when the droughts and the famines come, he says China will have fewer resources to cope. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Almost 70% of all the cargo that comes or goes from this country winds up passing through the Panama Canal. It's cheaper to slip through that 51-mile passage than to send all those goods down around the bottom of South America. But as the global economy expands, so too do the container ships that carry those goods. Work's about to begin on a project to make the canal big enough for its new supersized customers, a project that comes with a supersized price tag. Lauren Madelon reports now from Panama on who's going to pay.
The Panama Canal handles 6% of world trade every year. Until the explosion of Asian economies, ships known as Panamax, the largest vessels that could fit into the canal's locks, were the standard of maritime shipping.
Okay, right now, the vessel that this tug is assisting, the vessel is right now approaching the east side of Miraflores locks.
Max Newman heads the canal's tug operations. His crews nudge ships through the locks with often no more than a few inches of space to spare. Now, carriers can pay upwards of $250,000 to make the crossing, but the canal's missing out on even bigger fees from oil tankers, liquefied natural gas carriers, and bulk carriers known as post-Panamax. Those ships just can't fit through.
Did you copy 20 clear, Captain?
Affirmative, we copy, South 20 Tango.
Port directors from New England to Florida are salivating at the prospect of offloading the bigger post-Panamax ships, which now have to end their journeys from Asia on the West Coast. With bigger locks, Japanese cars and Korean televisions will have a more direct route to the East Coast, avoiding the cost of shipping goods from west to east by rail. To help pay for the new locks, higher transit tolls are being phased in starting this summer. They'll average 10% per year for 3 years. For now, at least, Panama won't issue bonds. Tug Operations Chief Newman says the bond option was never seriously considered. After decades of control by the U.S., he says this is the time for Panama to finance the project itself.
And now that we own the canal, it would be an historical error to do any business decision that would put in hands of others the ownership of the waterway.
There is an obligation on their part to explain why that model is being used versus a model where you would issue bonds.
Joe Cox leads the Chamber of Shipping of America. That's the trade group representing 85% of the U.S. merchant fleet. He's not happy his members are being asked to pay higher tolls now for a project that will benefit their competitors in the future.
Bonds are a way of spreading out the cost with current folks plus the cost to those down the road. It's a financing model that allows for those who are going to benefit in the future from the change to also fund that infrastructure improvement.
The canal's chief financial strategist, Jose Barrios, has received more than 20 requests from industry players asking for a delay in toll hikes. But he makes no apologies for using a financial model that he says will benefit shippers, many of whom may ultimately have to build post-Panamax vessels to remain competitive.
So I find it very hard to accept that my clients would tell me how I'm going to do my investment. I mean, nobody does that. I don't go over there to any of the shipping lines and tell them what to do, you know, with regard to the capital investments.
Carriers shipping from Asia to the East Coast do have an option, the Suez Canal. They won't have to pay higher tolls, but it would take several more days to complete the journey, doing little for the prices you'd pay for the cargo those ships bring in. For Marketplace, I'm Lorne Madelon on the Panama Canal.
Coming up, give me all your money.
I didn't really expect that it would ever happen. When it happened, it was strange. It almost surprised me.
Economics and rising crime. But first, let's do the numbers. Fresh deals and higher oil prices helped the market stay the course today. The Dow Industrials gained 8 points, less than a tenth percent, at 13,676. The NASDAQ put on 4 points, a tenth of 1%, to finish at 2618. The S&P 500 lifted 2 points, a tenth of 1%, to end the day at 1539. Dow Jones stock ticked down 1.7%. Rupert Murdoch met with the Bancroft family today about his $5 billion offer for the parent company of the Wall Street Journal. At last word, that company's future was still undecided. That takeover of Solectron by Singapore's Flextronics rocketed the U.S. maker of electronic components up about 15%. Flextronics nicked off 1 1/3%. Accredited home lenders rang up nearly 10%. It agreed to an acquisition by a private equity firm, as we mentioned. And Palm, the smartphone maker, jumped more than 9%. It's selling that 25% stake in itself to that private equity firm. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee discusses federal preparedness for this year's wildfire season. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa and Police Chief William Bratton are among the witnesses discussing the Fed's role working with communities to fight gang violence before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And events in Norway mark World Environmental Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Chalk went up for the right to swear on television. A federal appeals court ruled today accidental expletives that find their way to air aren't necessarily punishable by the Federal Communications Commission. The judges didn't throw out the commission's new indecency rules, did call them arbitrary and capricious, though, and said they might not stand up to First Amendment review in a lower court. The First Amendment also brought us the Laddie Mag phenomenon. 10 years ago, American consumers, male consumers specifically, were the target of a British invasion. Maxim magazine came to our shores, lingerie-clad babes on the cover and body humor inside, and plenty of cash in the corporate till. Maxim and its imitators were phenomenally successful until they weren't. And now Maxim's up for sale. Media Week's Lucia Moses has been covering the fall of the Laddie Mag and what made them so popular to begin with.
Well, we tend to focus on the women in the bikinis, but I think a lot of the appeal of Maxim was the peer-to-peer tone. It was sort of your older brother, your fraternity brother, taking you under his arm and telling you how it was and giving you advice and it was all done in a very humorous way. And that's something we hadn't had in men's magazines at that point.
What happened to send these magazines into a decline?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think a watershed moment was back in 2004 when we had the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction. That kind of brought out a conservative feeling in this country. And it was around that time when Walmart had pulled Maxim and its and the other so-called Laddie magazines from its shelves, just saying that it was just too much for their customers. They'd gotten customer complaints of the racy nature of the content. So, you know, advertisers who had been kind of sitting on the fence at that point said, you know what, this is just too racy for us.
So now there's a private equity group that's making a bid for them. Do you think the publishers of Maxim are going to get the price that they wanted or that they could have had 4, 5, 6 years ago?
You know, 4 or 5 years ago, this company was flying really high, and another publishing company that publishes celebrity tabloids supposedly made a run for the company and offered a pretty nice price for it, somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 million, I'm told. But the founder turned it down. He thought he could get more. Now it's pretty telling how far this company has come and gone, that the price tag being eyed for it now is less than half that.
So what do you think Quadrangle, this private equity group, might eventually do with these magazines?
Well, there's some speculation that that one of the three magazines, called Stuff, will fold. It was started to preempt one of Maxim's competitors. Now that that competitor is gone, it doesn't really have a reason for being anymore. So there's speculation that that might fold into one of the other magazines. And I expect Quadrangle, if they prevail, would make a big investment on the web. Perhaps they might buy other internet sites that cater to young men and heavy up an investment in the other areas where Maxim plays, like lounges, and there's a Vegas casino in the works, and in a string of steakhouses that are also in the works.
So the enterprise itself isn't gone, just the magazine, right?
Right, right. Maxim is a healthy brand today. Its value is in its website and all these brand extensions that give advertisers a way to reach young men who were turned off by traditional advertising more and more. It lets them reach men where they play.
Last question before I let you go. If you got the editor-in-chief of, say, Esquire in a room and asked him, so, come on, are you glad that Maxim came, or would you rather just have had them not be there at all? What would he say?
I honestly think he would say, Maxim did a good thing for us. It got men reading magazines again, and it got advertisers thinking more positively of men's magazines. It showed the world that, you know, indeed men can read magazines, and it forced them to define themselves a little bit better. Competition is good for everybody.
Lucia Moses is a senior editor at Media Week magazine. Ms. Moses, thanks a lot for your time.
Glad to be here.
The FBI report out today on the nation's crime rate has one of those bland bureaucratic titles. It's called the Uniform Crime Report. Once you flip open the cover, though, it becomes less abstract. The report confirms what police organizations and neighborhood activists have known for months, that violent crime rates are rising. Not a lot, just a percent or so overall, but still rising, after years during which crime, and especially violent crime, fell dramatically. Those were the same years the gap between America's rich and poor grew to its widest point since the Second World War. Marketplace's Steve Henn looked into expanding economic inequality and rising crime.
Chuck Wexler is executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. Wexler likes to think of himself as a kind of infectious disease expert on the lookout for the next plague. He sees today's crime stats as an early warning.
And in a lot of mid-size and large cities, we're seeing significant spikes in violent crime. Not all crime, but in violent crime.
Unlike the great crime decline in the 1990s, the changes now aren't uniform. In Los Angeles, Dallas, and Denver, overall crime fell, despite upticks in some neighborhoods. But crime rose in most large and medium-sized cities, shooting up in cities as different as Las Vegas, Nevada, Jackson, Mississippi, and Washington, D.C. The mystery, though, one that really no one has an answer to, is what's causing crime rates to change. In my own little four-square block neighborhood of Washington, D.C., within just about 1,500 feet of my kids' playground, the number of murders almost doubled to 7 in 2006. But you never guess it walking down the street. Big old townhouses are being renovated. A few blocks away, trendy little shops are sprouting like wildflowers. Candida Manzoni opened Candida's World of Books in 2004. Last November, her shop was broken into twice in 2 weeks, and she's been held up at gunpoint.
I didn't really expect that it would ever happen. When it happened, it was strange. It almost surprised me.
But criminologists say in some ways this is all kind of predictable.
The transition zones between wealth and poverty are where the opportunities for crime are greatest.
Jeffrey Butts is a research fellow at the University of Chicago. He specializes in juvenile crime.
When you're 15, 16, 17, you hear stories about how easy it is to force someone to hand over their wallet. You're not going to get on a bus and go across town to do that. You're going to walk to an area that's near you. Areas where the haves and the have-nots are in close proximity, you'll find those crimes of opportunity happening more often.
Butts says economic factors can tell folks a lot about which neighborhoods are more likely to be violent than others, or even what groups of people are more likely to commit a crime. What's a lot harder to understand is why one neighborhood or one city would see a sudden increase.
It's very difficult to predict crime trends, and we learned a lot over the past 10 years about how risky that proposition is.
Predictions in the early 90s that legions of poor young men would soon push up crime rates were way off the mark. Instead, there was a drop in crime that taught cops and criminologists something kind of counterintuitive. Crime isn't a given because of economic inequality. Criminologists say it's interesting to think about what stayed the same in New York City during the 90s. The population didn't change radically. Did the city fix its schools? No, not really. Was poverty wiped out? Not even close. Did illegal drugs disappear? Maybe from open-air street markets, but not in hospital emergency rooms. What about income inequality? In New York, it's still enormous. But the crime rate fell 74%. It turns out, when it comes to crime, it may not be about the economy after all. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, maybe you've heard it before. There used to be an old joke about Hyundai, that its letters stood for Hope You Understand, Nothing's Drivable and Inexpensive. Not true anymore. The Korean car company is coming up fast from behind another car maker's rearview mirrors. Hyundai swept 5 categories in a new vehicle quality survey out today, including large cars, small SUVs, and minivans. Last year, Hyundai didn't top any categories at all. Strategic Vision, the group that did the survey, though, said that the bigger story is the overall quality of new cars. Buyers of all brands say their new cars have fewer defects than ever before. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow ran up 8 points. We'll call that basically flat, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ skipped ahead 4 points, 0.1% there. The S&P 500 tiptoed up 2 points. That is about 0.1% there as well. Marketplace's producers include Megan Larson, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, grocery lists change, but stores, they stay the same.
The fact that they have so many low-end products that totally don't appeal to us make me feel like they're like in this transition of trying to serve two different populations of people.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.